Why does Alaska have such high numbers of violence and sexual assault? In a state that features incredible natural beauty and opportunity, there is also a dark reality of dysfunction. What can change these statistics and move our state into a healthier light? There is growing national attention to elevating the voices of those who for too long kept silent about the abuse they suffered. Will that attention help? Changing the conversation to stop violent behavior is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Last week during AFN, Alaska Federation of Natives' annual gathering, this year in Anchorage, resolutions were passed that called for training people about how to report sexual abuse and to support victims, especially children who have experienced assault. Alaska Native and American Indian people experience sexual assault at a much higher rate than other citizens. And the overall numbers across the state are some of the highest in the nation. Here to talk about what's known, about why rates are high, and to give some insight into new understanding of how to help are three professors from the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA professor Dr. Ingrid Johnson specializes in victimization and help seeking. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Angelia Trujillo has spent 15 years in the field of interpersonal violence, sexual assault, and sort of the intersection with public health. Dr. Trujillo, welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And Dr. Brad Merstel is a researcher, a professor who looks into policing and justice and how people perceive their experiences with police and the justice system and how that affects how well those things work. Am I characterizing that somewhat correctly, Dr. Merstel?
Very good.
Welcome. Thanks for being
thank
here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you, citizens of Alaska, can also join our conversation about Alaska's trouble with violence toward women and sexual assault problems here. And of course, we know that it's not just women who experience sexual assault and domestic violence. Children, men, boys, everyone is affected indirectly or directly by violence in families. Does your community have good services in place that help others? Have you helped others or needed that help yourself? You can call us with questions or comments at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK statewide. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's start with some background on the research that each of you is involved in. Dr. Johnson, I want to start with you. What are you learning about how victims of violence access help and how helpful that assistance really is? How it might be changing based on new understanding of what victims really need when they're in crisis?
So, as you mentioned, I do study help seeking and disclosure. So that means who survivors of intimate partner violence and sexual violence talk to, what they talk about, and the kind of reactions they receive when they talk to people. So for my dissertation research, I was looking at young women who were survivors of intimate partner violence, whether or not they talked to their friends and family about their experiences with violence, and then what kinds of reactions they got from those friends and family. And whether the different types of reactions and whether the disclosure itself shaped their experiences with violence. So whether it helped them get out of the relationships faster, whether it helped them experience less violence, and whether it helped them stay out of violent relationships. So this area of research is really important because what the research outside of mine has demonstrated is that by and large, survivors of violence are talking to their friends and family, and they're often talking to these friends and family and not talking to more formal services, so things like the police, medical professionals, other more formal agents, as we call them with research jargon. So that help seeking to formal agents is, of course, important. So my current research, I'm actually working with the Alaska Department of Public Safety, and I'm looking at how they provide services and assistance for survivors who report sexual assault. So there's several different threads of help seeking. So there's the more formal agents, there's the informal network members, and then there's sort of the intersection of the two of them. And that informal side and the intersection of the two of them is really a new area of research, and there's not a lot there right now.
Mm. Well, we'll drill down into more of that in a little bit, but let's keep going. Dr. Angelia, right? I got that
yes.
right? Oh, good. Angelia Trujillo, please describe your work in understanding interpersonal violence and that intersection with public health, and how you've been doing this work for a number of years. How has that changed the look at it, the research, and the understanding of it?
So the work that I've been doing is started out with sexual assault response and just being available as a healthcare provider to assist victims when they report to the police and advocacy and going through the entire reporting process and doing the exam. But I come to realize over the years that this is really a public health issue because sexual assault, domestic violence, strangulation, they don't happen in a vacuum. They impact people, relationships, communities, and even our society at large, and really is a much broader discussion. And so identifying and recognizing that, we see domestic violence and sexual assault together. We see strangulation and sexual assault, and we see child abuse and sexual violence. And so how do those all work together, and how do we then best support victims who are reporting? How do we best get them care? How are we funding those agencies, and how are we helping people understand how to respond?
Mm-hmm. And again, we'll drill down a bit as we go forward, but Dr. Brad Merstall, I want to get you in here as well. You've been researching the confidence or lack of it that different ethnic groups have in law enforcement and also the justice system. It probably won't be surprising for many listeners that white people have the highest level of confidence. African Americans have the lowest confidence in police, and Hispanic people are somewhere in the middle, which was interesting to me when I was reading through that research. And I'd like to know more about that as we go forward. But what did you find about confidence levels for Alaska Native people in both policing and in your research in perception of the justice system?
Sure. So that particular body of work that I've engaged in, I'm really interested in how everyday people interact with legal institutions and the police specifically, and what that means for life in a democratic society, what it means for developing best practice in policing. And in coming back to Alaska, I wanted to engage this research and make it meaningful here. And so I had questions about how Alaska Native people have experienced interactions with the police and what that means for their views of the police as an institution, overall trust, legitimacy, and those sorts of things. And initially, my hypothesis was that that would probably be pretty low. And in fact, what my research finds is that in a similar fashion to Hispanics, Alaska Natives sort of occupy that middle position between African Americans and whites in terms of overall confidence in the police, satisfaction with the police. And it gets a bit complicated and convoluted in terms of how it is that we come to understand that. Part of it is history really matters in institutional relationships and how people experience the police. And while I would never presumed to suggest that the experience that Alaskan Native and American Indian people have had with the police is great or even good, the historical relationship with African Americans and the police is qualitatively different, and I think that helps us understand sort of that middle position that my research has found with respect to how Alaskan Natives and American Indians view the police, their trust, their confidence.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're discussing research into sexual assault, how victims of violence access help, what we know, what new understandings are coming forward about how it is best to help people, both who are directly and indirectly affected by violence, and what their perceptions are of both policing and the court system, the justice system, and how we can better adjust things going forward by better understanding them. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255 statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So before we've got some calls now, and I want to go to the phones, but before we do that, the idea of having people, you know, like white people have the highest level of confidence, probably at least partially reflected by the fact that a lot of police, a lot of the people that are in that system are white. And so, you know, some of it comes down to race, feeling more comfortable, somebody that looks more like you. But do you think that how much does media play into the perceptions that people have? When I think about African-American people and what we've seen nationally that has been blasted across news channels for the last few years about shootings of black people by the police, how much of that influences the fear or perception that people have that they can't trust police in the African-American community? Is that being looked at all?
It is. It's not something that I've examined directly, so I can't speak, you know, directly to that issue and the influence of media and sort of metacognition and how people come to understand issues via media. What my research does examine, though, are the everyday interactions people have and how that matters for overall attitudes and outcomes in those interactions. And the area of research is called procedural justice, and it's really tapping the everyday things that both citizens and police officers can do in their interactions to produce positive outcomes. And what I try to do in my research is unpack for police, you know, that formal system of the everyday things that they can do in their interactions with people to produce positive outcomes, whether it's positive feelings, whether it's compliance with police directives and reduction of interpersonal violence and conflict in those interactions. You know, the way I phrase it to my students is every interaction matters, and positive interactions produce positive results, whether it's for the police themselves and officer safety or in citizens and feeling like they've been heard and that they are interacting with somebody they can trust and who is working for them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Loretto is in Wrangell. Hello.
Yes, thank you for doing this program. I think it is absolutely important for people to understand.
All right, did you have a question?
Yes. My main concern is our justice system. It seems to me we're falling through the cracks because of the way the domestic violence is handled in court, as well as the police. I just recently had a restraining order in the office that was handling it took the side of the gentleman who attacked me, who was my husband, and I could not believe when I told him that the man had a gun and he needed to take it away because I was afraid he'd shoot me or I was afraid he was going to turn it on himself in a suicide. I was horrified that he may even turn it on to the police, and they did not even take his pistol. They let him have it. So now I worry about the guy coming after me because they did not take the police, even although I told them to. And this gentleman comes from a background of post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam, and then he was a spook for the CIA, so he knows how to use a gun, and you never know when he's going to show up in town, and they did not take his gun. And I was not happy with the way everything happened. The police seem to take the side of the man. My question is, how can we fix it?
Well, thank you for your candid explanation of a situation that has you very concerned. And I think this kind of gets at the heart of a lot of this perception issue of how people are treated and then how likely they are to go back to get assistance perhaps in the future. Not knowing the case, of course, Dr. Merstall, what are your thoughts? And then I'd like also Dr. Johnson and Dr. Trujillo to weigh in about this idea of if people don't get the kind of assistance that they're seeking, what happens after that, and what are the outcomes?
Well, Loretto, I want to thank you for calling in, and that's a great question. And of course, I can't speak to your particular case, but what I would say, and this is a message in the procedural justice literature, not to just sort of pound on the point that I made earlier, but every interaction matters, and it matters not only in the immediate context of the situation that brought the interaction, but it impacts future interactions, the likelihood that people will come forward at all or cooperate with investigators in future criminal investigations. And so there really is the risk and negative interactions of a poison pill. And, you know, when I interact with my colleagues that are out there on the street as practitioners, police officers, right, I just try to emphasize to them that while a lot of the things they deal with are routine, it's not routine for the people who called them. Right. It's probably, you know, it's oftentimes the worst day of that person's life, even though it's one of dozens of incidents that that officer may have dealt with in that particular day or of that type over a month or a career.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Loretto's question is how to fix. And that's a huge question. What are some of the recommendations? You mentioned, you know, talking to police about remembering that what might seem routine to you is not to someone having a really terrible day. What are some of the other things that you could point to?
Yeah, well, the good news is that increasingly the research that we do, folks like us, is really beginning to bleed back down into academies and in-service trainings across the spectrum, whether it's police or prosecutors or even judicial trainings, right? And trying to let practitioners know what our research is telling us that we can then offer up to them to improve practice. And so I don't know, right, the extent to which any particular agency is including this in their training for their officers, but I am optimistic because I think research and the ability of research to contribute to better policy and better practice, we're in a new era, so I'm optimistic.
All right, and Dr. Johnson, you heard Loretto's account of this. What are your thoughts about, you know, the likelihood that, based on your research, that she's going to want to interact with folks on the law enforcement side again, and what that means for her potential outcomes in the future, and you know, having getting her life back to something that feels more normal?
Yes, so to start, thank you, Loretto, for sharing with us that it's very difficult to hear about those kinds of situations. I think what Dr. Merstel is talking about with procedural justice is also talked about in the help-seeking literature, though not generally using that terminology. Usually the help-seeking literature comes more from the field of psychology, but what studies there have found, it's the same story. So people who have negative experiences when they seek help for intimate partner violence are not likely to seek help again. And so that's really concerning when we think about how important help-seeking behavior is, because how can we help someone if they're not reaching out for help? So I think I would suggest that Loretto not lose her voice than anyone else who has sought help and feels a bit defeated by the current state of the system to keep speaking out, to keep seeking help. And that's the only way that we can do our research, and the systems can see that this is a problem and that we need changes in the system. So it's important that people keep talking, and I know that's difficult when they've had a bad experience, but that's what we need.
And all of that is moving toward what she's calling for, which is how do we fix it?
Right.
So it takes all these pieces together. Dr. Trujillo, the intersection of your research with violence and public health, which is fascinating to me, to think about how that may, if I'm understanding this correctly, how these interactions may affect someone's health going forward and what that means.
So what we know with people who experience sexual assault, domestic violence, is that they actually tend to have actually worse health outcomes in the future. And part of that is if they're not reporting, if they're not seeking that additional caregiving because they've been injured or are trying to get over from injuries from that, heal from that injury, It's important that those individuals keep talking about, just as Dr. Merstol and Dr. Johnson have said, keep talking, keep bringing it forward, talk to your provider, making sure that you are getting help and care that you need, both physically, medically, but also for your mental health status, so that you're able to maybe move towards healing in the long term.
All right, you are listening to Talk of Alaska on your public radio station. I wanted to also ask about a lot of what I read, you know, the research that was sent to us was not surprising, that people get help and have a good support system, whether it's formal or informal, are less likely to end up in a violent relationship again, for example. But as new understanding of how we're wired for trauma and what that means in the future and reacting to it in the future, what are you finding about new possibilities for helping people recover and thrive sooner, if there is that hopeful track out there? Dr. Trujillo, can we start with your thoughts on that?
You know, we actually recognize that there's what's called neurobiology of trauma, that when people experience trauma and negative effects, that it's actually hardwired into the brain. And so it is, again, that reaching out and seeking help, whether it's from medical providers or mental health providers, to kind of rewire those experiences in a more positive fashion and discuss them. And again, it's about talking and bringing those pieces forward. And so when we can do that, we can then actually seek to work for some better recovery systems in the long term. Because it is a different way of looking at it. This isn't about intimacy or sex. It's about power and control. And people who have been victimized need to be able to recognize that that is the case, that, and how do they then reframe their experience.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Johnson, would you like to add some comments about that idea of accessing help and kind of changing that, figuring out how to sort of rewire so that when you have future things that may be reminders that might be a post-traumatic stress reaction, that there are ways to help someone figure out a different way to deal with it?
Well, so this isn't an area that I typically do research in. I will say that implicit in the research that I do, you'll probably notice that I use the term survivor instead of victim. And so the reason myself and a lot of other scholars do that is we recognize the resiliency of people, and we recognize that people choose the labels that they want to put on themselves, and some people don't want to be labeled as a victim forever. And so using the label of survivor has this implicit meaning of recovery, resiliency, and being able to break that cycle for themselves.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of Alaska, and we're discussing research into sexual assault and perceptions on the justice system, on procedural justice, and on policing, and how to change the narrative, the conversation. Alaska has such high rates of violence, and the idea here is to look at the research to help change that story in the future. Our numbers to call, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions or comments, statewide is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to Matthew in Fairbanks. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Today I'm calling in reference to a question that has to do with the procedural aspect, be it formal or informal. I've come across a situation where there's a sexual assault dealing with minors, sibling on sibling. And so it's pretty difficult for parents, since the parents, you know, is the parent of both the perpetrator and the victim. But anyhow, just a real quick general broad rundown. 12, 13-year-old, 11-year-old, in that range, boy on girl. And OCS came, with police assisted, knocked on the door, and that's when the parents found out. They didn't even know about it until, luckily, it went through the school system, you know, and a friend you know, told the counselor, and the counselor brings in the victim. And so that's how OCS was involved in notified. Anyhow, the perpetrator had been in and out of different behavioral modification places, you know, going in for therapy and stuff, actually down in Anchorage for some fancy place, $4,000 a day for a month or something. These parents got a $150,000 bill on this kid. They didn't know there was a sexual issue going on. But anyhow, so OCS comes and the police come and everything is out in the open. The perpetrator admits to it. The victim admits to what happened. There's really not a lot of questions about it. And my problem is this, is the parents are pulling their hair out because the kid's got to go somewhere. The boy can't stay in the home, obviously. And so they found somewhere for the kid to go, you know, grandmother or a relative. But the boy needs to get plugged in. Now, obviously, I'm only speaking about the perpetrator. There's a lot of questions for help for the victim. But the boy has to get plugged in, and the parents are 100% on board with any kind of process required to get this kid some help, be it jail or mental health or any kind of aspect there. And OCS, DJJ, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, OCS, DJJ, I've called Commissioner of Health and Social Services, I've called Director DJJ. Everybody's helpful, they want to help, but I can't find an avenue where we can plug this perpetrator in while the cogs of the system, while the wheel's turning. You know, I don't know if they're going to treat it formally or informally. I imagine it'll be a formal. It'll be adjudicated in front of the court.
So you're looking for recommendations about what possible...
What can we do to get this kid, the perpetrator, I hate to say it, you know, the state doesn't treat sexual assault as a mental health problem. I seriously disagree with that, but what programs are out there that we can force, with parent support, a perpetrator into, you know, otherwise the kid's just out on the street not getting help, reoffending. In the meantime, what ended up happening was we had to send the kid out of state to a family member out of state, so it's OCS's problem somewhere else.
Let's give our experts here an opportunity. I don't know if their research is looking at directly at programs, but Dr. Trujillo, did you have some comments that maybe you could?
So I don't have specific research into programs here in Alaska, but I have worked for Alaska Cares, which is the child abuse response program here in Anchorage, and I did that for a number of years. And when you have a situation like that, which is very difficult, and thank you for sharing a really difficult, very impactful situation, there are programs, and typically OCS and DJJ will come together and as part of the adjudication process and make recommendations for sex offender treatment. And in the past, we have had pretty active sex offender treatment programs for adolescents. And so that's certainly an option, and that my thought would be that would come up as part of the adjudication process. And since I'm not entirely sure where you are in that, those would be questions certainly to ask. But we have had those in the past in Alaska, and my understanding is they're still active.
Well, and it seems that Matthew's concern and questions here kind of get at the heart of everything that you're doing beyond program recommendations, but just looking at people's experiences within the system itself and those perceptions of what's available, what isn't. He sounds, a bit frustrated by the lack of what they were able to find for assistance for this family that has a lot of trouble. Does this kind of get at sort of the heart of what you're working on, too, as far as this perception issue, Dr. Mercel?
A little bit. It's not directly what I deal with. I would say, though, a common thread that may link this particular circumstance to the work that I do is that there's a disjuncture between people's expectations of what they can get from formal systems and what they actually receive or can be provided through formal systems. And when expectations and reality don't meet, it can be very frustrating. And I think, you know, when we talk about DJJ, right, there's some structural constraints, right? So DJJ receives referrals from police agencies for, delinquent acts committed by youth. And then it only then can DJJ begin an adjudication process, right? So that's a limit to the system.
We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about how to improve systems and perceptions of justice and how to help survivors of sexual violence and domestic violence as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
This program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We have three University of Alaska Anchorage researchers, professors in the studio today. Dr. Ingrid Johnson specializes in how people access help after they have had crimes perpetrated against them, after they have survived a sexual assault or other types of intimate violence. Dr. Angelia Trujillo works in the field of interpersonal violence, sexual assault, and the intersection with public health. And Dr. Brad Merstall researches perceptions of citizens' interactions with both law enforcement and the justice system and procedural justice. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255 statewide. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422, and you can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, as Paul did. Paul is asking about what's known about the research on violence and sexual assault on women with disabilities, saying that there is a much higher rate of these types of crimes perpetrating against women, and he's wondering about specific strategies that have proven effective for women with cognitive functioning in the 70 to 90 IQ range, strategies for encouraging students to disclose abuse who are also experiencing some sort of challenges if they're deaf, blind, or have other challenges, and also for students who may have been abused by therapists who are in schools, and understanding what is appropriate therapy and what is not. First, how do you even find out about some of these things? And as researchers, how do you ferret out some of this information and work on accessing people who may need this help, who don't even know that they may need this help? If you've experienced something that has been repeated, if it's common, it becomes something that seems normal, unfortunately. And anybody's welcome to jump in here, how would you recommend for some of these questions that Paul has raised for people to better access assistance? or add, Dr. Marstall?
I don't have a specific recommendation. One thing I will say is that this is a particular point of interest to me and others in the Justice Center and what we refer to as disability justice. And with the support of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Justice Center and the Alaska Justice Information Center is working hard to get the information we need to understand the experiences of folks with disabilities as they come into the justice system. What we do know is that trust beneficiaries are dramatically overrepresented in Alaska's criminal justice system. And we're working to understand why and what we can do to help, because oftentimes folks who experience, whether it's cognitive mental disabilities or forms of dementia or substance abuse, those sorts of things. The criminal justice system is a pretty blunt tool that often requires a very precise response. And so, you know, one of the challenges that we're facing, though, is sort of what you alluded to, is where do we get the data? That it's not a routine data point that's collected in standard data systems that we use for our research. So we're working hard to try to understand the nature of the experiences with folks with disabilities in the criminal justice system and what we might do to make that system better and more responsive to their needs.
I know that doctors have continuing education all the time. Do judges and law enforcement folks also access training that helps them better understand how people might react to stress? Because everyone reacts differently. As you said, the justice system can be kind of a blunt tool. Well, if you're someone who experiences fetal alcohol syndrome disorder or other anxieties, things that may make you react to the stress of going to court in a much different way, where it's some people might have trouble collecting their thoughts and being able to articulate their concerns, or may have trouble really taking in what a judge is saying if they don't understand what this person that's in front of them may be experiencing. So what's known about how that type of training is or is not? Is there any understanding about that aspect of it, about training for judges and people that are working with folks that may be coming into the justice system that need more explanation, need more time to take in and absorb what's being said?
I think a really great example is the mental health courts that are being developed in Alaska and elsewhere that are really trying to find a way to deal with folks who come into that are justice involved. They come in contact with the system, but require a different set of tools to not just punish, but to help them avoid coming back into the system and exit with a good outcome. So I think that's a really good example of how research and understanding everything from the neurobiology of trauma to how various forms of disability may put some people behind the eight ball with respect to their engagement with the system.
Dr. Trujillo.
In the past 5 to 6 years, they've also been putting in place something called disability abuse response teams. So very similar to what we have experienced for sexual assault response, additional training for advocates, law enforcement, the legal system, healthcare providers to actually help them better respond to individuals who have the disabilities like we've talked about. And so those have been very effective in a conjunction with the mental health courts at helping people make those decisions and improve outcomes for victims.
Well, and helping people change their understanding of their own behavior and also what they may be looking for, whether that's healthy or not, in their lives. I think this gets at some of the accessing help and how it's perceived. I was a volunteer peer counselor at a safe house many years ago for women and children, and I remember a woman coming into shelter once who was in her third violent relationship, and she was so upset and so exasperated, and she said, "What do I have, a neon sign on my head that says, victimize me?" And I said, "Kinda you do, because that has become normal for you. So you're looking for somebody who has that same bad stuff, and you're unfortunately attracted to that until you really do the work of understanding yourself and move in a more healthy direction for yourself. You unfortunately may be attracted to somebody who has that same that same MO that you've fallen for in the past. What is the understanding about some of that? You talked about the hardwiring, Dr. Trujillo, and maybe accessing help. You know, this all comes together here with how people can have better outcomes and help themselves. Talk a little bit about that understanding of this hardwiring and how people can sort of redirect it and change that behavior going forward so they don't fall into that same trap. It might seem comfortable, but it's, of course, not in the long term.
So what we know is that this hardwiring, when people experience trauma, is that we learn to experience and accept certain behaviors. And so over time, those become very normal, very normalized. And so what we want to do is help people when they've come to the realization that this is not normal and not something that they want, that they, again, need to have that conversation where they're talking to either their healthcare provider or advocates in the community, their friends and their families, and that not only are they talking to them, but they're also being believed and listened to and guided to get assistance, not just assuming that, well, she has a neon sign and so that's who she is and that's how she's going to be. How do we then help her as a community, as families and relationships, to move that forward? Because this impacts all of us. So because this impacts the children that live in the home or coworkers or her ability to work or get even have insurance to seek care.
And it also so affects, you know, your ability to trust yourself, because as this conversation that I had with her, I said, yeah, if you're in a room with 50 healthy people and one violence perpetrator, that's probably who you're going to gravitate to, unfortunately. So changing that understanding of your own motivations and how to move in a healthier direction is so important. Dr. Johnson, the Me Too campaign, women coming forward online, I've gone back and forth. I posted my own Me Too story on Facebook about a year ago, but I have a little bit of cynicism about it. Does it change anything for people to come forward? Women have known forever that some people can't be trusted and will do bad things if they get a chance. How do we turn those stories into action rather than just quietly warning others to not be alone with this person or that person?
Well, it's not quiet anymore. I guess that's the thing.
That's true.
That's the whole point about the Me Too campaign, is that it's not quiet. I mean, I think if we look at Alaska, we are seeing a positive shift. So we're seeing from the Alaska Victimization Survey between 2010 and 2015, we're seeing both lifetime prevalence of sexual violence and intimate partner violence. Those rates are going down, as well as past year experiences with those types of violence. So we are seeing a shift, at least within the state, in the direction we want to see it shift in. And again, I would say that part of that could be because it's not quiet anymore.
So you think that creating more space for being allowed to speak out is helpful and also helps raise awareness about what's available for people?
Definitely. It's creating awareness about the problem. It's helping people make sense of what happened to them, you know, to hear other people make sense of their experiences, to sort of tie into what we've already been talking about. There's this concept of problem definition and the help-seeking conceptual model. So before someone can even decide to seek help or make changes, they have to recognize their situation as being problematic. Mm-hmm. And so the Me Too movement and just the general movement around the Me Too movement could be helping people make sense of what happened to them as being something that they need to address and that they might need others' help in addressing.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Tom is in Yakutat. Hi, Tom.
Hello, good morning. I'm thankful for your piece on the radio. It's way overdue that we talk about this problem publicly for a lot of reasons. I have a lot of layers I'd like to talk about. But education and talking frankly, about the situation is important, not just on the radio, but in the household, so that children feel comfortable listening to the topic, and if something happens, feel, for lack of a better word, comfortable to come forward and say, this was wrong, this happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
One of the points I would like to bring up is mandating for everybody to report a assault, a rape of a child to the public judicial system. I tried to pass a law a few years ago to mandate that, and it was bastardized to the point where it was only allowed if you volunteered more than 4 hours a week, you had to report. And I don't think, even if it's a lawyer who is tending to a perpetrator and comes up in their psychosexual analysis that there were other victims, I think that those names should go to a clearinghouse so that those people can get help. I had two children that were raped, and on two different instances, one took their life as a result of the trauma.
And are you saying, Tom, that you want names to be put into some sort of a database that then people would reach out to those other potential victims of a perpetrator and say, we know that this may have happened to you, do you need help? Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely. With the numbers nationwide that are victims, or as was stated earlier, survivors, I feel that child rape is probably a core contributor to our nation's woes. I think that there is an awful lot of things that happen to an individual when they're violated, and they act out in different ways. And we see a lot of different social inequities as a result of that. For those people to get help, I mean, we're talking about nationally, one in three girls and one in four boys, which are staggering numbers. You are talking about a fraction of those numbers who are coming forward and saying, this happened to me. I need help.
We're going to talk more about those numbers and about what's known about that with our expert guests here in just a moment. But we need to take a quick break as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. The situation that Tom was discussing that he raised about child abuse makes me also think about the larger issue of people in the system or that have not accessed the system for getting help, both themselves and others. Almost every woman that I've ever talked to about sexual assault, domestic violence, has had some story, whether it's a small encounter with somebody acting sleazy or saying rude things and making them feel uncomfortable to, you know, terrible violence and rape. What do you think the real numbers are? He was talking about how people are not reporting as much. Are you able to sort of get your heads around in your research how vast this may be as an underreported issue, both for adults and for children, and how to get at getting out more of that? He was suggesting that there should be a mandate that if a perpetrator of violence says, well, I also perpetrated violence against these other four people, that that should have to be put into some sort of a system of outreach to those people. Does that seem like a good approach to you? Or are there red flags about something like that that might, is it important for people to come forward themselves? Or is it okay to reach out to somebody who may have been victimized? Who wants to take that? Dr. Johnson?
Yeah, well, I can take the first part just about how do we know what the real numbers are. I mean, so the big thing that's important there is that there are victimization surveys. So when we think, when I talk about the Alaska Victimization Survey, that's randomized dialing of households looking for adult women to share whether or not they've been victimized in a number of different ways. So that's where we get the high rates of intimate partner violence and sexual violence in the state that are different from uniform crime report data, which are official crimes that were reported to law enforcement. So victimization surveys, although they have limitations because of who they sample and just sampling methods, are still going to give us much more accurate estimates of who's actually having these experiences.
Do you really have high confidence in something like that? Because I'm thinking about getting a phone call from somebody saying, hello, I'm a researcher. Have you been sexually abused? I mean, I just wonder how often people would be willing to disclose something so traumatic to a complete stranger on the phone.
Well, I mean, I do have some confidence. Obviously, there is going to still be underreporting. Mm-hmm. But these are studies that go through the Institutional Review Board process, so that's a very rigorous ethical evaluation of whether or not these studies are going to be safe for the people who participate. They're trained professionals typically conducting them. It usually starts with some rapport building, kind of softball questions to get people in the right space. There's a lot of precautions in place and forewarning about the questions that are going to be asked. So an environment is
created. So it's set up quite well.
It's set up to so that people aren't caught off guard. Most victimization surveys have to have that built into them because you can't just start right away with such personal questioning. Mm-hmm. So I do have some faith. I mean, there are, you know, of course, then there's issues of who gets sampled. So it's people who have a phone number. So there can be randomization of cell phones and landlines, but still that sort of eliminates people who don't have phones. Often it's non-institutionalized populations, so we're not getting people who are incarcerated. Mm. And then it's typically adults. So the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey is adults. That survey found rates of one out of every three women in the United States has ever experienced intimate partner violence, and that's rape, stalking, or physical violence. So it doesn't actually include sexual violence that didn't amount to rape. So it's actually much higher than a third of women in the United States, and mm-hmm. a quarter of men experiencing the same. So I think, you know, we do know that outside of official reports to law enforcement and medical professionals and those data, just from the victimization research, asking people themselves whether they've been victimized, that the numbers are quite high.
And Dr. Merstel, a lot of the conversation that's come from phone calls in today have mentioned this issue of trust in the system and the perception of whether or not there's adequate response and assistance through law enforcement and the justice system. We've only got a few minutes left, and I want to get takeaways from each of you about what you're hoping people gain from the research that you're doing and how this may affect change in the future.
Well, with respect to my procedural justice research, I've been really encouraged by the active engagement with the Alaska Law Enforcement Agency. It was when I was actively doing that research. It's been a couple years now, and conversations about incorporating it into both academy training and in-service training. I think that we live in a state where there's some tremendous police agencies who are committed to doing better, and they're actively seeking our help in doing that. So I find that really, really encouraging. What I would tell listeners is that it ain't perfect, but people are deeply committed to justice and are deeply committed to having it work better for everybody.
All right. Dr. Trujillo, what in your research, what are you hoping the takeaways are for the public and how this may improve access and public health going forward for people who are both directly and indirectly affected? Because even if you're a family member or a community member, a neighbor, a friend, these things affect you indirectly. And so what are the takeaways for you from how this can look in the future?
I fully believe that people who are willing to come forward, who are willing to talk about what's happened, whether that's formally reporting to law enforcement or completing an anonymous report or just even simply talking to their friends and family about what's happened, that this is an opportunity for them to start the healing process and move forward. Justice doesn't look the same for everyone. Some people think justice is having, you know, a court case that puts the bad guy in jail or the bad person in jail. Sometimes it's just being able to talk and start the healing process. And so I fully believe that if people are willing to come forward and talk about what's happened to them, whether it's healthcare, law enforcement, friends and family, that that's what we're going to be able to do. And so on the other side, the people who are listening to these stories, knowing what to do, what to say, how to respond to better support them, I think it's just that broader public health kind of process that's going to help everyone.
And Dr. Johnson, your research and your work with how people access assistance and how to help improve those things in the future, what to you do you want the public to sort of take away from that understanding?
Well, to echo Dr. Trujillo, I think it's this concept of justice being a highly individual concept. So I think it's important that we ask each survivor what it is that would be justice for them, and we do our best to help them achieve that justice, whether that's just being healthy and safe or whether that's pursuing something through the criminal justice system or whether it's both.
And Dr. Merstel, the idea of promoting confidence or the lack of it in the justice system, what is there research that looks into the perception of what people understand about policing and justice? You had research on normative police models, people sort of acting out of a sense of duty and belief that police have authority to give directives, such as saying, turn your music down, or motive-based trust. Do people understand well what the police have authority to do? Have you found that in your research?
Not very well. I think there's work to be done in educating the public of what the police can do for them and what they can't.
All right. Well, thank you so much to my guests today, Dr. Angelia Trujillo, Dr. Ingrid Johnson, and Dr. Brad Merstel. I appreciate your time. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.